Hello, and thanks for choosing this podcast from the Information Security Forum. Hello to everyone tuning in again, or indeed for the first time. Thanks for giving us your free time. Though I do have to ask, does anyone tune in anymore? I have no idea. I kind of see podcast as a slow radio, so I'm going to stick with that analogy, even though you didn't have to twiddle a dial to find us, I don't think. This episode is slightly different from the usual ones, as it is being done live. The two of us are in the same room rather than staring at each other through screens. And if you listen very carefully, you might be able to hear the other fella breathing. Thank you, Richard. Anyway, I'll introduce Richard in a moment. This episode is all about research at the ISF, how it is changing, and as well just looking at some of the subjects we are researching. My name is Mark Ward. I do research at the ISF, and I mainly work on Threat Horizon. I'm the full-time employee on that. And the way that has changed or is changing is symptomatic of the way research is being refined, redefined at the ISF. And we'll talk about that here. And as he breathed on us earlier, it's Richard Absalom, the longest serving member of the research team, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, been here for a while. He is. And thanks for telling me to breathe down. To be fair, I am one of those people that needs a mic in real life. So it's good to actually have one in front of me. People might be able to hear what I'm saying.
Softly spoken. Do you also carry a big stick?
Try not.
But yeah, I guess you've seen a lot of changes though from research. Even because I was here, I've been here 4.5 years, and a lot has changed since then. But even from even further back, if you can remember that.
Yes, so 8 years in a research role with the ISF, we especially recently, I would say we're looking at more change. So we can talk about a threat horizon. Obviously, we've been changing that quite a lot the last couple of years. But what we're doing more recently is more kind of little and often research. Mm. We have several insights series papers going on around key themes such as AI, ICS, security leadership. So we've moved away from some of the longer format reports, or we haven't delivered them in a while.
Yeah, I think I did one of the last ones of those. That was the governance, nurturing governance report, wasn't it? That was a sort of 9 month.
Yeah, and I was working on measuring security.
Of course.
I've done several of those over the time, but they do take up to a year to produce. And I think personally, there's still scope for us to do them. So in case
you're
fans of the longer form research out there and are worried that we're ditching them, no, we still want to be able to do it when the opportunity comes up. But they take a long time to produce. Sometimes it's been a case where someone asks for research and 2 years later they get it, if at all, because it takes that amount of time. But at the same, I'm personally a fan of long form content because I think the ISF can do that. It's different in these days of everyone wants an answer, quick snap straight away. Complex challenges don't often have simple answers, and it takes a lot of time to find the approach, and we get that right. But at the same time, so I think what we're trying to find is a happy medium, meeting complex.
Yeah, because it was definitely the case when I joined that it was, there was the briefing papers and those longer, chunkier reports. And I guess we've acknowledged that information security has changed, and just the pace of things has sped up, and there is that need for those shorter pieces of work. But that's not to say they're less, they demand less of us, because certainly the ICS and the leadership and the one that Lee's starting to work on, AI, there'll be as many encounters with members and conversations and all kinds of things across that project. It's not like we're neglecting any aspect of that in-depth research effort at all.
I mean, fundamental to the ISF research and why I've been here 8 years is the membership, the people talked to, the expertise that's out there. I kind of see us as conduits of the expertise. We kind of ingest information and experience and knowledge and wisdom from the crowd, from a large crowd of very experienced, clever people that are the ISF membership. And we can then, not regurgitate, but we're essentially taking in that information and validating and working out, okay, what does good look like in terms of mission, and pushing it back out to the rest of the membership. So most of our members will understand most of the topics we're talking about, at least to a certain degree, but with hope that everyone learns something new, because they're not learning from us necessarily, they're learning from each other.
That's very true.
That process is very interesting, and from my point of view, but just valuable to have that input.
Yeah, we do.
Absolutely keep that.
Yeah, we definitely facilitate that at workshops and Congress and chapter meetings, just getting the people with similar problems in the same room and sharing that. But also, I think, that's one of the great things about working here is just that you give people that broader perspective that we do sample very widely. I certainly on the governance report, I talked to so many CISOs, yeah. And some of those calls were, most of them were great for the research, but also a lot of them were not quite counselling sessions, but they were definitely sort of trying to help people get a perspective of what other people were going through. And certainly towards the end of that research, because I had a very clear idea of what governance looks like across that membership, it was really useful. And there were some great conversations, just, you know, some of that information really, people just that moment of, oh, right, okay, now I know where I am. Yeah,
there's a light bulb moment sometimes. I found that the particular example I'd use is talking about mergers and acquisitions. So to be honest, a topic I'd never really looked at. So I was a completely blank slate to start with in that research, as is often the case. But I found myself after interview 20, talking to people who had with experience in the area, but offering them insight or telling them that they hadn't thought about before. And that's not down to me. That's down to this is what I've heard from other people going through. And as I say, I probably spoke to about 30 different people. That was for a briefing paper, so pretty short for research. But as I said, by interview 20, 25, I was not only taking in information, I was also able to help people think a bit differently or think about something they hadn't considered before. And that's where you start to realise, okay, that's where the value is.
Yeah.
So we're helping, you know, we're that connection between members that...
I think, it works on all kinds of levels. Some of it is just the mechanics and knowing how something is being done across the membership because people are all different levels. I think there is, and again, the value is in locating yourself in that spectrum of practice, but also then there's those deeper insights too. It's just a sort of for InfoSec as a practice and just how it's changing, and I think that's definitely useful. But I think as well we should acknowledge that some of the other work you're doing is looking back at our library, because we sometimes find that people, the members, rightly, because it can be tricky to find it on ISF Live because there's a lot of stuff there, and but we do have a library that's deep now, and a lot of it is still relevant, though you're working on updating quite a bit of that, aren't you, as well?
Yeah, so we often tend to focus on strategic issues. We're not technically focused most of the time. It means our reports often stand the test of time very well. So the examples I'm working on at the moment, so we are relaunching a series of papers around security awareness. I should get that wrong. We're not talking about security awareness, it's really about security culture and the human factor. We want to very specifically get away from just talking about awareness and get people to change behaviour.
Yeah.
And on that note, one particular report I think was published in 2014, so 2 years before I got here. Yeah. That's called From Promoting Awareness to Embedding Behaviour. And we looked back at that and thought, that's still so relevant. The solution, it's based on a lot of 2014 data about what the problem was, but in terms of the solution of, okay, how do we know people want to get away from just talking about awareness and running phishing campaigns and awareness campaigns that someone clicks and 5 minutes later forgets it, to actually, no, what you really need to do is create a secure culture, embed secure behavior, people just do things out of habit. That report and that, the solution it provided is still absolutely relevant, but people might not necessarily look for it, or they might see it and say 2014. We're updating that as part of that series because it makes sense. The solution still works. We think it still answers a lot of the challenges that people ask us about.
Yeah.
On a similar vein, an even older report was engaging with the board.
Right.
And again, it's talking about, we're including it in the human factors re-release because board members, guess what, are human.
Outwardly, at least.
So, executives, leaders on a human level. And this report, it looks old, the current version. We are republishing it, make it look newer and better. But the content, the example I'd use is when doing the measuring security research, so I talked to a lot of members that work in interviews, and a lot of the questions that were coming up and a lot of the issues and challenges people had in terms of finding the right measurements, communicating them correctly with the board or the various different people around the organization. Every time the board came up, I was like, we kind of already answered this. This is a problem that's been going on for a long years. There's a report that's been published in 2013, absolutely still relevant. It's not technically focused on any specific technology. Yes, we've updated references. It talks about the importance of social media and mobile.
We've got past that. Yeah,
but tech moves on, and the board becomes interested in the new tech as it is. But the essential challenges of this is how you need to get your message across, how you engage with them, hasn't fundamentally changed.
No. And I think, and it cuts across a lot of the areas we cover as well, because I've certainly encountered that. doing the next gen CISO paper in governance, and then helping Paul Watts do the leadership series. I mean, that's all about that communication.
And so from talking with Paul, from reviewing the papers he's working on, from talking with the various members, that paper from 2013 is still very relevant. More like, why are we still having this issue? It's because people look at a paper from 2013 and think it's not relevant. And so that's, we're not doing it because it's, oh, we're running out of things to talk about. It's like people are asking us questions or have challenges. Yeah. We think we have the answers to them. They're called answers. So let's get them back in front of.
Yeah, I mean, because the end result of this, not to let the research department take every day off, because we just point people to say, yeah, we've done something on that. Because I think that's where the insight series come in, is that need for faster answers. Those topics are definitely looking at those, because they're very fast moving. And I did some work on machine learning and did an appendix about generative AI, because that was just coming up on the rails and that was something we just could not ignore. And now businesses are different and AI is making a huge difference to all of them in all kinds of interesting ways, interesting as in the Chinese curse. So I think and Lee doing that series on that is going to be really interesting, because I think he's been inundated, if that's the word, by members who are like, yeah, let me know about what's going on with this. I think it's one of the, it's absolutely lit a fire under a lot of organizations.
I think that's another example of how the stuff we've done stands the test of time as well. So I know took my own horn, I covered a paper on demystifying AI information.
That's right.
Back in 2019. And I look back at that before kind of getting into the work that Lee's doing. I thought, actually, this is a pretty
solid piece of work.
In terms of it was looking ahead and the stuff that we talked about happening is now happening. So it's not that we haven't covered this area before, but I remember at the time thinking this is our first foray into AI becoming interesting, but not many people have that much expertise in it. So let's just set out what it means in general. But I always had the idea is we need to do more research on that. When the time comes, there's a whole depth of research we can do on, how do you use defensive AI? How are the bad guys using it? How do you protect your own AI systems, which is what you were getting into in the securing operational ML paper. As Lee's paper is, we'll talk about a whole load of other things you can talk about around ethics.
It's very interesting. What's
it do to the security workforce? So that's where that insight series is going to go, covering off all those different aspects in which AI is going to impact information security, which is great. It's showing, we picked up a topic 5 years ago now, got a bit ahead of the curve, but now what the difference is, the technology is here, it's working, it's being adopted, but also there's that expertise within the membership.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's some people to call on. I think, and as well, there's a lot of people who can see it's about to hit them, or is hitting them, and they sort of want some guidance quicker as well, and definitely we're answering that. And I think as well, just on that sort of the AI side, the good thing about that project is that it will feed into Threat Horizon as well, and that's one of the other things we're trying to do, is just get more joined up about all those things. And there'll be stuff that has emerged from the ICS series Paul Holland did, and certainly the leadership as well, that will feed into Threat Horizon. So we're trying to be more holistic, if that's not too hippie-ish a word, about things, but sort of just more and a better engagement around the team. And one of the other things we're definitely doing is building up communities around those projects. I think every single one, leadership, ICS, AI, and even Threat Horizon now has a decent list of people that get involved, and we're doing discussions and roundtables. So we're trying to maintain those links, and it's definitely having an effect. Certainly with Threat Horizon, there's people now who, hopefully when they get a message from me, they don't go, oh God, it's just another ISF thing. Actually, they do see it as the sort of more of, it's part of that community, and they know who they're going to be talking to.
And as with all these things, you get out what you put into it. There's got to be some give and take. From our point of view, we want to be able to connect people and be able to feed back information and good practice, I guess, kind of before they might see a report, and that's the benefit of being in the community. I guess we should say as well, if there are particular topics that people, let us know. We have the mechanism with the Future Research Hub. We're trying to update exactly how that works. The idea being, we're always going to be member-driven in terms of what's important topics and, what are your challenges and solutions. We're generally a pretty friendly bunch.
Tell us what to do. Yeah, because I think that's the whole point, isn't it? Sort of we're... yeah, where we do what we're told in some respect, and sometimes don't. But I think, because I think sometimes as well, the good thing about a researcher is, I mean, it's, and it's a very luxurious position to be in, is you do have time to sit back and go and stroke your chin and go, wonder what's out there.
It's, I think, yeah, I always have to remember that this is a privileged position. We can take the time to do this and think fairly deeply of the complex problems that, frankly, yeah, security practitioners just don't have, lighting fires every day on with this stuff on a day-to-day basis, and they're kind of waiting for the 3 a.m. phone call. We generally tend to get a decent night's sleep.
Or actually, mice in the loft, which I've got at the moment, so I have to woke me up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Thanks, mice. Different kind of problem.
I think it is a privileged position, not only to get the time to talk, but people tell us stuff that they wouldn't necessarily tell other people.
That's very true.
Because we're that kind of trusted intermediary. We're not a competitor to any kind of commercial outfit trying to sell them something, a new product or whatever. No, it's like we're just...
We do get incredible access to some very large organisations, and always we're very thankful for it, because it is absolutely solid. But I think as well, I mean, I was at a conference this week which was about crime science, which does sound very sci-fi, and it was a bit. But that was just brilliant, because it was people who are studying this for a living, and some people who are in industry who are trying to do something about it as well. And it was a great meeting. I think it was the 15th year it's run, and it's grown every year, run by UCL. And it was just, there was so much in there that kind of thought, yeah, this is going to be an issue. And, you know, one of the big ones was ID, because of deep fakes, but also just efforts by governments all around the world to do digital ID, because they want to make various other things easier. And yeah, there's a lot going on. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. But it was great to be in that position. Yeah, there's a lot that will build into that. There's people doing stuff on ransomware, there's people doing stuff on actually studying the efficacy of cybersecurity as a practice. I really want to talk to them. That'll be fascinating. Yeah, proper professors looking at it and saying, did that work? Did that not?
Yeah. And I guess into obviously some of the work I've talked about there around measuring security, and like, how do you actually measure how well security is performing to assurance? There's all kinds of ways of thinking around that. So yeah, definitely interesting to see how that comes up.
Yeah, they'll feed into Threat Horizon. But I think, I mean, that again, that's the sort of the point at which we don't do what we're told is looking slightly ahead and like you say, stepping out of the trenches and sort of in Threat Horizon, the clue's in the name. We do look a couple of years out. Yeah. And some of
what's coming down the pipe. Yeah, so thinking about new topics coming down the pipe, what's covered in Threat Horizon, for instance, do we need to start thinking about quantum computing, quantum encryption?
Yeah, well, we've been thinking about it quite a long time, because I've done some work looking back at sort of the last 5 years of reports, and it's lurked on that horizon for longer than we expected it to arrive, if that makes sense. So yeah, I think for the last 10 years we've been saying next year it's going to happen, and it hasn't. Things are getting slightly more tense in that space, because there's some engineering challenges have been solved, but it's not clear if that's going to lead to super duper quantum computers anytime soon. But the standards work is definitely rolling on, and that certainly throws responsibility back on organizations to do something to prepare one way or another. And there's been, I think, Apple and Google, a couple of other folks have started to work with quantum-proof encryption algorithms. So yeah, there's some work to be done there, which we need to look into. But it's going to be of that type, rather than all bets are off because quantum computers are here.
Yeah. I was going to say, I remember I've been talking about it since at least 2017, because it got into Threat Horizon 2020. So yes, we wrote it in late 2017, published early 2018, with the idea that the quantum computers arrived by 2020. Now, when we did that, we knew probably wasn't going to happen by 2020, but we wanted to get people thinking about it.
Yeah, being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. I remember writing a piece about quantum canaries as well. It was an opinion, but saying, how do we know when a quantum computer turns up, and what are going to be the warning signs? Because let's face it, it's going to be a national security agency, not to name a specific NSA.
Yeah, but some government somewhere is going to want it and use it. Because I think, I suppose, part of the consequences of it appearing are interesting. Maybe we will explore some of that, because one of the other aspects that is definitely coming up quick is ID, because the way that the bad guys are moving and the way that sort of technology is developing and the way governments and regulators are looking is that ID is becoming much more about zero trust type stuff, authenticate and understand and study behavior, so you are as sure as you can be that the person that is doing a thing on your system, that's buying your service or whatever, is the person they claim to be. And that's getting wrecked by deepfakes, getting skewed by misinformation, disinformation. There's all kinds of stuff happening in that space, And there's a lot of, as well, machine identities and all kinds of other stuff going on, because if you're doing automation, then you've got sort of avatars or agents or something like that as well. So that's going to become nasty, I think. And we've had conversations here about, you know, small organization, but that ID burden is becoming pretty heavy.
Yeah, it feels like it. I mean, it's, again, stuff we've talked about in Threat Horizon over the years, is this complete breakdown in trust, or, you know, essentially not knowing who you can trust anymore, or not being able to trust anything anywhere, whether it's online or in person. You're like, who are you talking to? What information is real or not? Kind of a scary post-truth world.
Yeah, well, but we're seeing the emergence of ID service providers. I mean, some of those are credit agencies like you'd expect, but there's some new kids on the block as well, sort of based on biometrics and, you know, those fingerprints that they look for on your devices, and how you, you know, even down to how you hold your device, and sort of how you, and all kinds of things like that, which are useful and can help them be as sure as they can be, or as they need to be, depending upon their risk appetite, that they're happy to, for you to trade, or for you to use that credit, or do that thing. But that's only going to become more of a burden for organizations, because that means lots of new partners, and the certification process for those service providers ain't great at the moment, and certainly they're nowhere near good enough for, say, you building a digital identity yourself and using that one identity and that one package of credentials to do everything. It's just not, you know, there's a lot of people who just shy away from that, saying, no, I don't trust that, thank you very much. And go back to some of those older methods. But there's a lot of pressure happening in that area. That will be an interesting one to explore for Threat Horizon.
Okay. I was going to say, you're volunteering for a paper there. Just going to carry it into Threat Horizon.
Yeah, at some point, because you've got MFA, you've got all kinds of stuff happening on that as well. Chatting to, like I say, us, the way we do things here, and trying to get at all the services we have. It's useful, but it's not straightforward. There's all kinds of interesting ways it can go wrong. And I think that's why it pops up as a Threat Horizon possible, because it demands a different response. And certainly that's what we've been looking at with Threat Horizon, is just, well, if everybody has the same kinds of problems, let's not write about those, let's write about the other stuff that we weren't expecting, that does demand that you do something different, and that, you know, your information security arrangements have to be adapted to fit. Which is the whole, you know, the essence of Threat Horizon, really.
I was going to say, in that sense, well, you're probably the best person to talk about it, what's happening with Threat Horizon.
We shifted it from those 9 discrete threats to scenarios, and then this last year we made threats the center of everything, and we had 62 threats in there, which, to be honest, is probably a little too many to track. So we're doing a lot of work on understanding, you know, how we, and we've got a lot of engagement with members, very grateful for all the feedback we're getting from that, and we're sharing some of the tools from that we produce for the report with those members as well. So yeah, trying to make it a much more... So
trying to find the sweet spot as to how many threats to cover,
sort of ways to communicate.
And
as well, we're trying to adapt it so that, you know, for practitioners, they do get the nutty details, which is what they need and want. But also, if you're communicating with it sort of above your pay grade, you know, to the board and beyond, then it's a much less technical and a much more business-led type.
How do you make it interesting
treatment.
Or grabbing? Grab their attention.
Yeah, just sort of don't tell them the bits, you know, the nuts and bolts, but, you know, the shiny bit on top, that kind of thing. Which doesn't detract from its usefulness at all. I mean, sort of ideally, it makes it more useful, because you know, there's ways to understand it. There's better ways to use it to help other people understand, because it is a bit abstruse if you're not doing it day to day. It's an interesting project to be on, because it keeps on going, keeps on changing. Change again this year, not a huge amount, but it will be refined, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that's part of why I've been here 8 years. There's always something new carrying on. You know, there's the access, like we talked about, you're in a very privileged position, you can talk to lots of different people, but there's always new topics coming up, new angles, essentially trying to continue evolving the way we do things to provide as much value as possible across the membership. And I think there's a few lessons I've learned over time in terms of, you can't necessarily please everyone all the time. You know, we're writing novels rather than being a consultancy business. So, you know, we absolutely recognize that some people might not always agree with what we say, or might want us to do something different. But that's great as well. We want that kind of feedback. You don't like something we've said, come and tell us, because it makes sense. You know, that's how we make things better.
Definitely.
Make sure those kind of voices are heard
We reflect those needs and wants. Yeah, it's certainly true with Threat Horizon, just that, you know, that's getting adjusted because of the feedback. Some of it, most of it positive, but some of it sort of constructive criticism, shall we say. And that's definitely a good thing, because, you know, but as well, I think we... do have a limit to the amount of changes we can make, because there's only six of us, and you know, there's a lot of members with a lot of, and that context and maturity is a real defining factor for how they consume our material as well.
I do sometimes think that, I think people think we're bigger than we are at the ISF, and I blame Congress. Because Congress is such an awesome event, and it's so big, and there's so many people involved, and actually the team kind of doubles in size because we're bringing contractors to help run it, and there's this expectation, oh, the ISF is a large organisation. It's like, we're a pretty small research team, which is part of why we have to focus on specific areas and kind of keep working.
I mean, I think the ISF as a whole is trying to grow, so we may get bigger, but it's not going to go from 6 to 30. There's only going to be another body or two. So it's,
it's a not-for-profit, right?
Exactly. We're not going to throw a lot of resources at that. And sort of, suddenly have people lining up to use desks. And things. We're pushing the capacity of our current head office. But it's a good place to be. I mean, I think there's a lot of things happening, and I think that small size helps us, because there's a lot of serendipity there as well, and just that sort of what we work on, we do all throw in together.
Yep.
And you have a conversation and say, oh, that's interesting, or I know someone, or try this, or oh, I saw that news item, and we're quite collegiate in that respect.
I'm finding that, I think I mentioned, doing the quality lead role, I kind of don't oversee, but I am involved pretty much in every project we do now, so it means sometimes my own research is taking a bit of a back foot, because I'm having to spend more time on everyone else's projects, which has its positives and minuses in terms of interest, but it means I'm learning a lot just because I'm nosying in on everyone else's research.
Quality lead or nosy? Leave that to debate.
Same thing.
Thank you, Rich, and I hope this has been a useful and interesting exploration of how research works at the ISF. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. You can now find ISF podcasts on all major podcast platforms. Just search for the Analyst Insights name on wherever you get these things, or you can look on Audio Boom, where you can hit a button and subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode. The podcasts are also available at securityforum.org, where you can also learn much more about ISF research, tools, and guidance.